All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim.
And welcome one and all to episode 30 of the SLS Cast. That's right, we are now at the Triple X episode. But unlike the wrestler who you're disappointed in when you find out he's fake, and the porn, which can sometimes be disturbing, we're just right.
That was a very epic. It was very epic. Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. Thank you. Yes. I you know, now that I'm kind of realizing this is my shtick at the beginning as well as the spiel at the end, I'm really thinking about these things. I find myself up at night, or I'll be at work and I'm driving and I'm like, man, I gotta think of something. What can I do that'll go with 30? And I'm like, wait a minute, in Roman numerals that's XXX. Hey, I think we got this. So, oh, I am Matt, by the way.
And I am Tim. As you know, yes. Matt is the eloquent speaker of the
group. I was eloquent. Shit. Yeah.
Words.
Look, I'm my own Bo Burnham episode. Okay. So what's been going on in your world there, Mr. Tim?
Not much. We been actually, it feels like we just recorded the episode the other day. Which technically we did.
It's funny. It feels like it was only 4 days ago that we did this.
Yeah, and I actually just now posted the episode, last week's episode, like maybe 5-6 hours ago. So I haven't had a break yet from your voice, which is not a bad thing. It's a good thing.
Well, I do like to try and have the dulcet tones soothe versus harm. I don't want to have those, hey there, sweetie, how you doing, kind of voices. I'd much rather have the where you almost want to fall asleep, but you don't, because it's comforting, it's soothing, but it's not boring. It's not Bueller, anyone, it's not that.
It sounds like you could host BBC.
Ah, man, if I could pull off a really good British accent, I would love to be able to do that. And now you're listening to BBC World Service. This is Matthew Quinton.
That was okay. That wasn't bad. I mean, you even got the nice little, you know, the pitch up, the step up in the voice. BBC Service.
I don't know. I feel like I have a better kind of Aussie thing in general than anything else.
Oh, can we hear?
Of course, I can do all your requisite Southern accents and all that kind of stuff. But
yeah. I would like to hear your Aussie if you can. Do it right now.
Okay, well, let's try this. I'm gonna jump into the first news item because it's really, really short, and we'll do like a little tiny mini news segment here. And I'm just gonna read my thing from comingsoon.net about Sir Ian McKellen finishing the Hobbit thing, right?
Okay.
And from comingsoon.net, they say, while it's not exactly news, it surely is a momentous occasion. Sir Ian McKellen just finished filming scenes as Gandalf for the Hobbit films, as Peter Jackson just posted the following with this picture. Seconds ago, we finished our last shot with Gandalf. This end of an incredible adventure that began in 1999, I'm feeling very sad right now. What do you think?
Not bad.
Pretty good.
Not bad. You sounded just like a Peter Jackson.
Cool! I guess what? I can do a Peter Jackson impersonation. I had no idea I could do that. That's outstanding. Another person that I look like the before picture of and not the after.
Oh,
I'm going to have to work
on
that. Not
that again.
Well, it's true. It's one of those things where I definitely know that I'm fat. That's fine. And I should lose some weight. That's fine. But I'm also not one of those people who mistakenly believes that just because you're fat, you know, that's the only thing that could ever be wrong with you. There are plenty of thin people who have fucked up problems and are really worse people than I am, so I'm okay with that. Let's just be honest. I'm also one of those people who thinks that it's okay if you want to be fat, but don't pretend it's anything like I've got a thyroid problem or I'm just big boned, whatever. And right. Third rule is, it's okay if you want to be fat, cover it up. Nobody wants to see that fucking shit. That's it. Those are the rules of being fat, alright? That's fine.
Can you write a book and just call it Nobody Wants to See That Fucking Shit, and just have your face, like, pointing to the reader?
Yeah. I don't know. I would do it, but it would have to be on the shelf next to Dennis Leary's book, Shut the Fuck Up by Dr. Dennis Leary. That would have to be right, those two books, they would be right next to each other, I think.
Do you ever, like, go in, I mean, you don't, like, do what they did for the Heat poster and airbrush your face so you have, like, a very anorexic-looking face.
Oh, that would be terrible. Where they did, like, yeah, where I've got a fat fucking body, but somehow I managed to tone my face. I got the little chin exerciser thing. They actually make this. It's hilarious. It's this... It basically looks like a Pez dispenser, but it doesn't have a flip top, okay? It's just the top is kind of square. And so you put it against, like, your clavicle, right? Just where your collarbones meet,
yeah,
at the top,
yeah,
of your chest.
That's a good word. I haven't used clavicle in years. I've kind of forgotten about that, to be honest.
I tell you what, you don't want to obfuscate the use of the word clavicle. That's right. I can play in a dictionary. It's cool. So anyways, so you set it there, and then the other part of it goes under your chin. And literally, you are just supposed to make a nodding motion. And you make the nodding motion, and I guess this thing has resistance on it. So it's hard to make the nodding motion. And it's supposed to make that little double chin go away. So that this way, you can be fat, but have an amazing Facebook picture.
Since a lot of people that are fat only take Facebook photos kind of facing down, so the chin kind of like covers everything else. And they're usually super close.
Yes. Actually, you can usually tell the dead giveaway of a fat person trying to hide it on Facebook is the camera is angled downward at an angle. Okay, so it's not like a straight shot. It's if they took their left hand and they went up so that they have to look up and then off to the side so that they're now looking up and off to the left with their eyes, not so much with their face, but it pulls all the skin down on your neck so that you can actually see just a jaw. When you see those, run. Fellas, run. I mean, unless you're into that kind of thing, and then it's okay. Those are the ones who are trying to hide something.
Well, I'm really glad that our geeky movie podcast doesn't really cater towards overweight guys, or we would be in so much trouble right now.
I'm an overweight guy. I cater to myself. That sounds good because it's a triple X thing. Yeah, I cater to myself. Anyway,
Or that can be the name of your other book. I cater to myself.
That reminds me of probably the best Rodney Dangerfield joke I ever made up. I don't make many claims in the world of comedy, but I did make this joke up.
Let's hear it.
All right, here we go. Oh, I get no respect. No respect whatsoever. I tell you, ATT wouldn't even let me reach out and touch myself. Oh!
Nice. Tip of the hat to you.
Thank you. Yes. And how was your, how was your week? Or I guess your last 4 days.
It's been well. Last Friday, I saw three movies in a row. It's been a while since I've done that. I've seen two in a row often, but three in a row kind of take the cake. And since all the movies were at least 2 hours long, or about 2 hours long, it made for a really long day, a really long Friday. And I never thought I'd ever say this, but I actually got kind of sick of sitting in a movie theater that long.
Makes you wonder how Ebert did it all those years, huh?
Well, that's why he had I don't want to say anything criticizing, because I don't know if it's too soon or not, but that's why he had kind of like a fat ass.
Well, see, that's not entirely true. If you ever looked at Siskel, managed to stay in shape. Of course, he had cancer and died, so maybe that's what kept him in shape at the end. I don't know. And it can't be too soon for him. He's been dead for, like, what, 15 years?
A while. Now? Yeah, it's been a while. But I went to Monterey, California, Saturday for a wedding. So we drove up there, took the 101 up into Monterey from L.A., and it's super pretty. I mean, we didn't quite make it over to the Pacific Coast Highway, because that would have taken probably about 2.5 hours longer. But, man, Canary Row, all those places, the wharf over there in Monterey is absolutely beautiful. Have you ever been to Canary Row, where John Steinbeck wrote that famous novel of his?
I have not, unfortunately, no.
Oh, you would love it there. I don't know why you would love it there, but it's pretty. So I would think you'd like it there. I mean, do you like the history of canned fish or canned squid?
I'm going to go with no.
No, then you wouldn't like it there.
Yeah. If it's pretty, though, I wouldn't... I'm sure I wouldn't mind passing through. I do have to know, though. You've been with your girlfriend for a while now.
Yeah.
And I don't want to get too personal or anything, but are y'all comfortable enough in your relationship that you can go to a wedding without it kind of getting weird after?
Oh, totally.
Without the kind of where's our future?
Well, that's how every day is. So a wedding is kind of like a cakewalk for our relationship.
Well, all right, that's cool. Yeah, I don't have to worry about that. You know, when you've been married like I have for many years, and there is no where is our future, it's what the hell have we done with our life. It's more like an assessment of what we've done versus what we're looking forward to.
Yeah, Chelsea and I have a very interesting relationship. We count our months. Like, for some reason, like, a month seems like a year. So technically, we've been together for over 12 years now. And it kind of feels that way. I mean, I guess I never really experienced 12 years of being with the same partner or anything, but, you know, it kind of feels that way. Even like whenever I'm prepping for the show or we're watching a movie, for example, The Paperboy, she'll just turn and look at me and say, "You're going to use this on your show, right?" Or she'll say something and I get to steal the words from her mouth. And I guess that would be that's like a relationship copyright infringement law. At least there should be a law about stealing words from your girlfriend or partner or whatever. But I do that because, you know, I got lucky. She's a pretty funny woman.
Well, yeah, my wife has this unique ability. Jen has this amazingly unique ability to be both supportive and not supportive at the same time. You see, she is very supportive of the idea that I have worked with you and we have this podcast. Oh, you know, Matt's got a podcast and he likes to watch movies. She will not sit down and watch a movie with me. She doesn't listen to anything. It's a real pain in the butt to get her to watch the kids for a couple hours so that in another room or whatever, so that we can have quiet when we record. That kind of thing. So, but yet she definitely doesn't mind that I do it, and she thinks it's nice that I have a dream of one day becoming super famous with our podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So she is both very supportive and at the same time stubborn about not helping when I need help with it.
She doesn't listen to the show, does she?
Never.
Never?
Not even once.
Really?
No. No.
Oh. Well, good. So this won't turn into like Dick Van Dyke
situation. I could literally
situation.
Lead a double life and talk about hookers and blow all the time.
We talk about that more often than you think.
And the sad part is, she still would never know, and my father-in-law listens to the show.
Does he still? Is he still an avid listener?
Not as avid as he used to be, which is probably why I can still get away with it. Oh, Mike, if you're listening, you know I love you
guys.
Yes,
you know this will be the show he decides to start
listening. This will be the show that, of course, he listens to, and he goes, "Oh my God, Jen, did you hear it? He's got hookers and blow." And she's going to be like, "What? Is he blowing a hooker? What?" Her mind doesn't work that way. She's got a very wholesome kind of mind. It's kind of cool in certain regards and incredibly annoying at other times. But this is not the complaining about your wife cast. This is the SLS cast. And I say, let's get to the news.
Yes.
All right. So I only have four pieces of news, one of which I did in the attempt at the Aussie accent there for
which
me.
You did well.
So, but that was thank you. That was real news, though. It was from ComingSoon.net. Sir Ian McKellen. It was a big thing. Peter Jackson actually put it up on Twitter with a picture of Gandalf still in character, dressed up. And the closing of it was the closing caption, along with the picture, which is kind of cool looking, is, "We'll get to see McKellen as Gandalf two more times, this December in The Hobbit, The Desolation of Smaug, and in December 2014 in The Hobbit, There and Back Again."
Yeah, and they also did a production, they released a production video, a blog, I think yesterday or today.
Mm-hmm.
I know I've been waiting for one.
Yes, he's actually really good. That's one of I think that's one of the reasons why Peter Jackson maintains his popularity, is because he truly does try to make his work as interactive as possible. He really wants to share the experience with the fans and let people in. And it's just something that truly resonates, and I think that's really cool. I have three more things of news. One is the confirmation that everybody knew was coming, but no one wanted to hear. And that is that according to Parallel Universe, from Don K of Parallel Universe, this is MSN.com, Christian Bale won't play Batman in Justice League. The end-all be-all here is that after playing the Caped Crusader in three movies for director Christopher Nolan, the Oscar-winning actor said he was hanging up the cowl. Unless, that is, Nolan wanted to go for a fourth film. But the filmmaker himself has moved on, saying that last year's The Dark Knight Rises definitively ended his stay in Gotham City. Yet, with the questions of Man of Steel being successful and possibly paving the way for the Justice League movie, which would star Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, The Flash, other DC comic heroes, the article asks, is there any chance that Bale would reconsider? The answer is no. Speaking with Entertainment Weekly, Bale said, quote, "We were incredibly fortunate to get to make three Batman films. That's enough. Let's not get greedy. Chris always said he wanted to make it one film at a time, and we ended up sitting there looking at each other saying, we're about to make the third. We never really knew if we were going to get to be there, but if that was how it was going to be, this was where it should end as well." End quote. Now, the article goes on to say that Man of Steel writer David S. Goyer, who is the man now most likely to write the Justice League movie, has said that the Batman who appears in the League's lineup will be a different version of the Dark Knight. Bale says he hasn't heard a thing about it. Quote, "I have no information, no knowledge about anything. I've literally not had a conversation with a living soul. I understand that they may be making a Justice League movie. That's it. It's a torch that should be handed from one actor to another. So I enjoy looking forward to what somebody else will come up with," end quote.
So the kicking the Bale story is true.
Second to last, two fun, very fun fact things here, because I'm all about weird factoids here. This comes to us from virginmedia.com. This is the 20 biggest movie flops. Now don't worry, this is a list, but it's an easy list that we can go through here, okay? K-19, The Widowmaker from 2002, total money lost, $69.3 million. And here's the kicker. Harrison Ford, when he did this movie, I don't know how the hell he managed to pull this off. He got some ungodly amount of the gross. It was somewhere around the neighborhood of 40% of the gross was what this guy got. So that's probably one of the reasons why this movie lost as much as it did. Yet, 69.3 puts it on the list for the 20th. Number 19 was Ballistic X versus Sever from 2002. This one lost $70.1 million. This is the sad part is because this was based on a not particularly popular video game, and then the movie stars the not particularly popular double act of Antonio Banderas and Lucy Liu. And it had an estimated production budget of $70 million, and that was before marketing. Now, this one, my kids like this movie. I was not convinced that it was going to be a good movie and did not end up watching it. Number 18 on the list, Walt Disney's Treasure Planet. It lost $70.4 million. It had a $140 million budget and barely picked up $70 million, and critics didn't like it. It was still nominated for an Oscar, but it was one of those technical Oscars.
Yeah, I actually hear from some people that I follow for movies, and they actually say it's pretty good. It's one of the unknown treasures.
From what I saw of it, because the girls were watching it last mm-hmm. week, and the few little bits that I saw of it seemed interesting and seemed to follow the book pretty well, and yet here was getting panned, and my girls loved it, for whatever that's worth. Number 17 on the list, How Do You Know? This one lost $71.3 million.
What movie is it? I've That's not really ringing a bell.
This is the one that I have absolutely no idea. It's a dating movie. It had Reese Witherspoon, who made $15 million, Jack Nicholson, who got $12 million, and Owen Wilson, who got $10 million for their parts. I want to say it's like a romantic mm-hmm. comedy. Given that this movie lost $71.3 million, I think I know where 37 of that million went.
Yikes.
Number 16, Land of the Lost, 2009. I can tell you right now, I never watched this movie. It looked terrible.
It's a lot better than what one would think. Technically, the movie is really cool. And it actually has some pretty funny stuff. Danny McBride's in it, so he kind of makes the movie worthwhile.
True, and given that I do love Danny McBride, I may have to go back and watch this movie now. But this one lost $72.4 million. Battlefield Earth 2000.
Classic.
Number 15 on the list, $73.3 million. And proving yet again why people don't like Scientology. Because even when they try to put an action-packed movie together out of this stuff, nobody understands it. And that's all I have to say about that. Number 14, Supernova, also from the year 2000. This one lost $75.1 million. I have absolutely no idea what this movie is about. However, it was a movie that no one wanted to take credit for. The director was Walter Hill. Perhaps you've heard of his work. He did The Warriors and 48 Hours. He officially took his name off the sci-fi action thriller after completion. The studio allegedly called on Francis Ford Coppola to re-edit the movie after it had been shelved for, get this, some years. Scary stuff. Number 13 on the list, Nutcracker in 3D.
Yeah.
And this was from 2010. This one lost $75.3 million. Apparently, this one cracked its nuts for like a day, because I don't even remember this one being advertised, much less it being in the theater.
Well, because apparently the movie is really dark and kind of depressing. I think the really only kind of worthy actor in the movie that would have drawn anybody in was Nathan Lane.
Maybe. All I can tell you is that this movie made $65,000 in its opening weekend in the United States.
Jeez.
Number 12 on the list. And now this is a movie that I actually liked. It is by no means the best movie in the world, but it did not, I feel, it got a bad rap. I just feel that this movie got a bad rap and nobody gave it a chance and nobody tried to understand it. Final Fantasy, The Spirits Within from 2001. Number 12 on the list. It lost 81.9.
Yeah, that's a really good, that's a technical achievement of a movie right there. Phenomenal.
Oh, you like this movie?
Yeah, Final Fantasy, yeah. Yeah, I actually went and saw it. I was only one of the few people that apparently went and saw it at the movie theater.
Well, see, when I went and saw it in the movie theater, the theater that I went to was pretty full. I went and saw it opening night. And it wasn't like waiting in line to, you know, fighting people to get in and sitting in the stifling heat or what have you. But the movie theater was pretty full. I would venture to say 80-85% full. I don't know. I thought that this movie was good. But unfortunately, apparently, Tim and I were the only ones who thought it was good. It lost $81.9 million. Number 11 from 2005, Stealth. Now, this was a movie that looked like crap. Took me about 4 years to finally watch it, and then I realized it's not a completely terrible movie.
Really? It actually has some redeeming qualities to it?
It had a few. Think HAL from 2001 meets Top Gun. That's what you have.
It's a very interesting movie parody
right
there.
It is. Basically, you have a stealth fighter that is completely AI controlled and then ends up taking over, becomes self-aware.
Dave, do you want to go to the danger zone?
Exactly. I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't let you go to the danger zone.
I would love to see Hal or hear Hal sing that damn song that Tom Cruise sings in the movie.
Oh, when you've lost that loving feeling?
Yeah.
Indeed. Number 10 from 2001, Town and Country, lost $94.6 million. This was probably the movie where people finally said, I think we've had enough of Warren Beatty.
I think that's one of the last movies he's done, to be honest. I can't think of
it. I'm pretty sure. This was a romantic comedy that starred Warren Beatty, Diane Keaton, Goldie Hawn, and Gary Shandling. This one got so out of control, some cast members were actually paid twice due to the extensive reshoots. And in the end, he lost his studio almost $100 million. It was $94.6 million. Number 9 on this list, Cutthroat Island from 1995.
I love that movie. I remember seeing that movie at the movie theater as a kid, and I just thought that was a really cool pirate flick.
I'm like you. Like, I was a 95, so I'm 18.
Mm-hmm.
I saw this movie, and I was like, wow, this is a pretty cool movie when I was 18. I watched it about 3 or 4 years ago, and let me rephrase that. I tried, because I got about 25 minutes in, and I couldn't. I stopped. I was like, wow, this movie's bad. I almost built the TARDIS so that I could go back in time and smack my 18-year-old self head upside the head and go, what the fuck are you wasting your time watching this movie?
Yeah, it's funny thing that Gina Davis was once a sex symbol.
She was hot then.
It's funny comparing like what was considered hot in the early 90s considered to what is hot now, especially with like the the leading guys as well, like Matthew Modine and Cary Elwes. It's like you can't have like a Princess Bride guy. What's his name in Princess Bride?
Wesley.
Wesley. You can't have like the Wesley type character in a movie now and still be considered like a major hunk by a lot of people. They have to be kind of like the Tatum Channings of the movie industry today. Kind of buff, a little bit more muscle.
Maybe. I think if you did it right, people could probably do it. But yeah, I definitely understand where you're coming from. Now, number 8 on the list, 1999. I actually like this movie. This is a movie that I, even to this day, I like. Maybe they just spent too much money on it, and that was the problem. But this is 1999's The 13th Warrior. Lost $98.3 million.
That's the Beowulf movie, right?
No. That was Beowulf. Beowulf was the Beowulf movie.
No, I mean, like, this was a different take on Beowulf. This was with Antonio Banderas?
Yes, this is the one with Antonio Banderas where he's basically an Arab. He's exiled to the land of the Vikings. And then he ends up going on an epic quest with said Vikings and takes out a whore, a witch with an army.
Yeah, that's supposed to be like a different interpretation of Beowulf.
I see. Well, John McTiernan directed it. I really like this movie. I think it's a great movie. I would definitely give it 3.5 stars. Right between liked it and really liked it. Because there are some technical issues with the movie, but it's still a lot of fun.
Yeah, I agree.
Right. Now, this one I am not at all surprised to see on this list in any way, shape, or form. From 2011, number 7 on the list, Green Lantern. Lost $105.1 million. Yeah.
That was one of the first movies we reviewed, too.
Yes. And if you think about this, this movie was, according to Virgin Media, the superhero movie was savaged by critics. And although it made over $200 million worldwide, we shudder to think how much money was spent on advertising for it to still lose over $100 million. Number 6. Not surprised to see this on the list for myself. 2008's Speed Racer with $106.1 million lost. And this is the Wachowski brothers, of course, back when they were still the Wachowski brothers. Now they're just the Wachowskis. People thought that what the technology that they could bring to, that they brought to the Matrix, bringing it into the world of Speed Racer, they thought was going to be an amazing thing, because then you could actually take all the cool aspects of the anime and bring that to life in a glorious technological fashion for quote-unquote live action. Turns out, not so much. There's a reason why Speed Racer has a cult following.
And I'm one of them.
Very cool. Number 5 on the list, 2002's The Adventures of Pluto Nash. This one lost $112.9 million. This is another one where I think they just went a little too crazy on the budget, because the movie itself is not terrible. It's not a great movie, but it's an okay movie, and it was pretty funny. I just think that they tried way too hard on the special effects and probably paid some ridiculous salaries for this movie. And I think that if people were to just kind of sit back and enjoy it just for a simple, fun popcorn flick and not try to take it too seriously, I think that people would enjoy it more. Is it going to make its money back at this point? No, but that's okay. Number 4 on this list, 2004's The Alamo, with a staggering $119.2 million. I was so looking forward to this. Number 3 on this list. I was so, so looking forward to this movie. And I was so, so greatly disappointed when I saw it. 2005's Sahara.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this one was Matthew McConaughey. He actually went out of his way. Took his own time, his own money, and actually did some of the marketing and stuff himself. He actually got one of those billboard trucks and spent like a month driving it all over the country himself to promote the movie and try and generate buzz for it. This is a movie based on a book of the same name by an amazing action writer named Clive Cussler. And I was so excited because the book was fantastic. Clive Cussler is able to take actual historical information and true stories and things that are just outstanding and amazing, blend it with nautical science, real nautical science, and then turn it on its head to tell a fun story. And in this particular instance, we actually find that a Confederate submarine, the Monitor, was it the Monitor or the Merrimack? I can't remember. Whichever one it was, that is actually found in the Sahara Desert. And you're like, wait a minute, how the hell is it even possible for something built in the 1860s to make it to Africa? And yet, if you look into nautical science, it is actually possible. It's the theoretical possible ones, where every single possible thing would have to go exactly right for it to happen, but it could happen. And not only that, it was lost at sea. It gets found in the Sahara Desert with Abraham Lincoln's body on board. Oh my God, this book is just really, really cool. And so I was so excited to see this movie because this is one of the best Clive Cussler books. This is a guy, by the way, who wrote a book called Raising the Titanic before the Titanic was found. And they took his notes and what he had done after it was found. He was off by like 2 nautical miles where he said it was going to be versus where they found it. So this is, the guy does know what he's talking about. This movie was just the shits. It was terrible. It was poorly done. They changed every cool aspect of the book save one. They changed every other cool aspect of the book. And then they scratched their head after spending $241 million wondering how the hell they lost $121.7 million of their budget. Oh, so mad. So please, if you ever hear this movie, go read the book. Number 2 on the list. This is the movie that nearly ended Robert Zemeckis' career. Mars Needs Moms, the 2011 motion capture animation flick. This was what was to be Disney's biggest financial failure ever. It lost big time money, $136 million, number 2 on the list. It did result in the closure of the Image Movers Digital Spec. It closed it because of how bad this movie did. And yet, while they thought that they were going to get away with it, nope, sorry. They then turned around the next year and 2012 and did John Carter, where they then lost $200 million. At number 1, John Carter, $200 million. But don't feel bad for Disney. No, they still had enough cash at the end of the year to go buy Lucasfilm for $4 billion. So don't worry about them, they're okay. Last but not least, a much shorter list. These are the 8 roles that Johnny Depp almost played. He was actually up for the role of Jack Traven in Speed. And so then Keanu Reeves gets this role, and because of the success of Speed, he gets cast in The Matrix that was also looking at Johnny Depp first. So that's kind of interesting, I thought. When he was young, they were looking at him for Ferris Bueller's Day Off, but John Hughes said that he wrote this part for Matthew Broderick, which is why he ultimately beat out Jim Carrey and Tom Cruise for it, not just Depp. They also were looking to get him the role. Johnny Depp was originally supposed to have the role of Lestat, and they thought Tom Cruise was more marketable at the time, so that's why they went with him. This one is kind of crazy. Johnny Depp actually expressed interest in the role of Johnny Blaze from Ghost Rider, but apparently Nicolas Cage wanted it more, so they gave it to him. He was also supposed to be... They actually offered him the part of Bruce Banner in 2003's Hulk, and he turned it down, which was probably one of the best decisions he ever made. Turns out also that Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt might very well still be married today. That's right, Depp was originally cast as John Smith in Mr. and Mrs. Smith, but he turned it down eventually because he said he was overworked from all his other projects. Last but not least, Depp was also considered for the part of Pumpkin in Pulp Fiction, but the role ended up going to Tim Roth. And that is my news.
Alrighty, so my news. First up, and this is an article from CinemaBlend.com by Christy Puchko, and it says this. The former Republican senator of Pennsylvania, also known as Rick Santorum, who threw his hat in the presidential race of 2012, has been elected the CEO of Echo Light Studios. That is right. Rick Santorum is now a CEO of a pretty big, starting to establish itself, religious movie production company. It's a pump. Echo Light Studios is a company that plans to, quote, produce, finance, market, and to distribute faith-based family films across all releasing platforms, end quote. And that was according to Religion News Service. The site claims that Echo Light has a full pipeline of films with established directors and a growing cadre of faith and family stars as committed as the directors and producers. The newly formed studio will release their first feature called The Redemption of Henry Myers on September 1st of this year. Then, 2014 will see the release of Hoovy, a reportedly inspirational biopic about Illinois basketball player Eric Hoovy Elliott that boasts stars like Patrick Warburton, Laura Hawley, and will be helmed by Soul Surfer director Sean McNamara. Santorum announced his CEO title last Saturday while on the Mike Huckabee Show by saying, quote, "This is the right place and right time, and I've jumped in with both feet. I often say that culture is upstream from politics, and I know entertainment also can be strength and light for people who wanted to be uplifted and reinforced in their values." End quote. Well, I gotta say, you know, more power to him. There is definitely, from being an avid movie watcher, there is definitely a lack of wholesome family entertainment. So just because he is gonna be, you know, this is supposed to be a religious, faith-based production company, I can see them producing some quality, decent, probably more likely semi-corny, family-friendly films in the near future. Now moving on, this isn't really movie news, but it is kind of Star Trek news, only because it's kind of science-y and it pertains to planets and William Shatner. And I don't know, Matt, have you ever gotten to the whole thing about buying a star? I know for a while they had things like you can fill out and you can spend like $200 and you buy a star for yourself, so in case the world ever blows up.
Yeah, that I could never quite understand that. what are you supposed to do with that? Is this going to be one of those things where, like, 2,000 years, 3,000 years in the future, you got some indigenous alien planet, and this guy just comes landing in, shows him the piece of paper and says, "By the way, I own this planet. I'm just letting you know. I own everything in this fucking star system. Could you see that star right up there? That's called a star, by the way. We call that a star. That star up there, see, I own that. My great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather paid $200 to some idiot star registry and said, 'Hey, give yourself a star.'" I don't know. That's the only thing I can fucking see happening. I think it's one of the stupidest things I've ever heard of. And there is no way to legally own a star.
It seems like that you would have to go and claim the territory in order for it to technically be yours. Like, it has to be inhabited by someone of your own species before anything like that can really be divvied up.
I don't even see how the... Yeah, but that's the whole thing. I have absolutely no idea how that would even work out. Because this is assuming that you have the ability to do it, and that the alien people out there are going to let you. You show up with your little piece of paper saying, "I own the whole solar system because I own that star," or "Pay me money or I'm going to blow the star up." I don't... They'd probably just, you know, I mind control you, anal probe you, and then leave you in the vacuum of space. But they would, like, frame that certificate and leave it hanging up in the chief alien's home.
Yeah. Just picturing all that, I think that would make an excellent, futuristic documentary right there. That'll be the found footage movie of the SLS cast. Well, the SETI Institute, a scientist named Mark Showalter, discovered two new moons, temporarily dubbed P4 and P5, that are circling the devoted to dwarf planet Pluto. And he decided to kind of leave the naming of these moons to the internet, so everybody like can get on the internet and, you know, just anything like that. So I'm sure this guy got a lot of very interesting names. Now I'm going to be reading from another Cinnamon Blend article written by Christy Puchko, and it says, quote, "Over 2 weeks in February, people could vote on a selection of names or suggest their own, and ultimately, 450,000 votes were cast. However, Showalter knew better than to leave this entirely up to the whims of the internet. So, he made the Kavat, the final name must somehow tie into Pluto, the Greek god of the underworld. This meant that names like Eurydice, Alecto, and Persephone were okay, but paired names like Stephen and Colbert, Mickey and Minnie, Potato and Potata were dismissed. But Wired has revealed that things got sticky when William Shatner and the might of Star Trek fans got involved. When the first Captain Kirk found out about Showalter's poll, he called out to his Twitter following to vote for a suggestion. Vulcan. The name tied nicely into Pluto's mythology, as Vulcan was the Roman god of fire, the metalworking, and volcanoes. Of course, it also ties beautifully into Star Trek, as Vulcan was the name planet of Mr. Spock with Shatner's boost. The name Vulcan shot to the top of the poll with 170,000 votes, followed by Cerebrus, the three-headed hellbound hellhound that guards the gates of Pluto's underworld, with 99,432 votes. But there was still one obstacle before the names were official. They had to be approved by the International Astronomical Union. Some recent tweets from Shatner will tell you how that went. And his tweets are, "They didn't name the moon Vulcan. I'm sad. Star Trek fans have had it rough. First, JJ blows up Vulcan, and Al Seti finds a loophole to deny it from coming back." So, he tried, and he fell. Poor Shatner. What will he do now? What can he name? Now, obviously nothing. In other news, again, this is from CinemaBlend.com, there have been many of movie titles that have gotten into trouble, and they have been threatened by other movie studios and other directors because they may have had the same name as their films or a film that was owned or produced by another film company in the past. Well, cinema, if you had not known by now, has been around for over 100 years. And when you're dealing with that kind of a time frame, there's no doubt that certain film titles are going to overlap. For example, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And there was drama when Paul Haggis called his Oscar-winning film Crash, since David Cronenberg had already used that title for his car accident fetish drama. The producers behind Neil Burger's 2006 ghostly drama The Illusionist got prickly when it became clear that French director Sylvain Comet's L'Illusionniste... Well, it's French, but in English it pretty much comes out to be The Illusionist, would be plainly translated for its release in the US. Both of these films couldn't feature movies more disparate in subject matter, so anyone who mistakes them just isn't paying enough attention. And the quote goes on, "But if you manage to mix up Lee Daniels' upcoming politically centered biopic, The Butler, and Warner Brothers' 1916 silent short film of the same name, then maybe you should stop reading the story and call your doctor." Apparently, Warner Brothers will not allow this studio company, the Weinstein Company, from releasing Lee Daniels' film. So we will see what's happening with this. I mean, this is obviously a pretty dick move by Warner Brothers' part. And the article also goes to mention that this is a bad move because, especially since the Weinstein Company so graciously allowed Warner to keep the title of their film The Good Lie, despite it sounding like the Weinstein Company film The Good Life. In this case, Warner insiders, while assumedly sticking their noses in the air, the Weinstein Company should have tried to clear the title earlier, and that they're protecting their rights because they can. Yeah, we will see what goes with that. It's kind of an interesting situation. You don't see this happening too often, but when it does, I guess it's kind of a big thing because you also have DVD sales, Blu-ray sales, movie rentals, movie video on demand downloading, and all that jazz to account for. So you don't want people to mix up your potentially good movie with a potential bad movie. I guess it'd be one thing if they're both supposed to be really good movies, but if one sucks, then I guess that's the problem. And then finally, my last bit of news, Warner Brothers and Legendary Pictures, who have had a pretty good bond partnering together for many years. They worked with Batman Begins, The Dark Knight Trilogy, the Hangover films, Inception, Man of Steel, 42. They are actually going to be splitting after many years of being together. And this is from Collider.com by Adam Chitwood. And they say, quote, Legendary CEO Thomas Tull, however, has been looking to wield more creative control over the studio's content as of late, which is presumably the reason that the company is in the market for a new distribution and possible co-financing partner. Additionally, Variety reports that Warner Brothers has been looking to develop more properties alone rather than partnering with co-financiers. The studio is reportedly hoping to approach its multiple DC Comics adaptations much in the same way it produced the Harry Potter franchise, which means mostly going solo on the production front and reaping the rewards. It wasn't necessarily these two companies, again, Warner Brothers and Legendary Pictures, are splitting because of creative differences. I mean, with these major studios, they don't have creative differences. I mean, I think it's kind of, you know, I mean, it's kind of like if Brian Grazer and Ron Howard, you know, they like to produce and make movies together. Brian Grazer obviously producing and Ron Howard directing. If they have a working conflict, they kind of do their own thing. They don't always have to direct and produce the same movie. But with Warner Brothers and Legendary Pictures, they feel like, that is not the issue, or I don't think that's the issue, because obviously one of them wants to make more money. And how is one way to make more money if, you know, you have another studio kind of clinging on and reaping the awards or getting all the rewards that you can be getting more of? You know, that's kind of a shame that something like this has to happen, but who knows? I'm sure these companies will go off and still do amazing things, and the less fortunate company will go on and find another partner out there to go and make more excellent movies. Those will be my news for this week's episode XXX.
Woo! All right. Man, wish we could have found some Vin Diesel news, because, see, that would have also been good to tie into the XXX thing.
Yeah.
All right, well then, let's go ahead and jump into our next segment, 3 Squared. Yes, this week's 3 Squared is our favorite Roland Emmerich movies. Now remember, Roland Emmerich has to destroy the Eastern Seaboard in virtually every movie he makes. However, before he got into this kick of doing that, he actually managed to make a couple of movies where he did not. He did things like Universal Soldier. That's right, this was the guy that did Universal Soldier. Can you believe that? I couldn't believe it, let me tell you. It kind of blew my mind. Yeah, I mean, it pretty much started with Independence Day, and more or less hasn't stopped. Well, except for Eight-Legged Freaks. That was pretty funny.
Oh, wait, he did that?
But he didn't direct that movie. He just produced that. And I think we're pretty much tied for two of them.
Oh, definitely.
I'm not even trying to argue and, like, say, no, you should come up with something, or I should come up with something different. So I'm just going to go ahead and say that the one movie that I have that Tim doesn't is Stargate. It launched several successful television series, which I was very happy. This is a 1994 American-French science fiction film where a massive metal ring with engraved cover stones or what have you is discovered in Giza, Egypt in 1928. And they then flash forward in time to basically 94, where James Spader is playing a guy by the name of Dr. Daniel Jackson. And he is like, oh, I'm telling you, the Egyptians, they actually came from outer space. They were aliens. There's no way you could do this. And so he's just kind of missing that one final bit of proof. Everybody thinks he's crazy until he says he gets put in touch with someone who's like, look, no, it's the Stargate. Go. So they find the Stargate. They pull him in. He's like, okay, let's go make this thing work. They figure out how to make it work. Kurt Russell then plays Colonel Jack O'Neill, who's a special forces dude who's got his own baggage because his son accidentally killed himself. And so now he's kind of suicidal. And he's like, well, this is going to be my last mission. They get the Stargate working. They go through. And then that's when they realize, oh, well, I guess we should probably fix and find the Stargate on this end so we can get home. And that's how the rest of the movie plays out. And then, of course, there's the alien aspect, and there are people over there. And, yeah, and it was a very interesting show or movie. And there's a reason why it spawned the successful TV series, because this is it makes a very compelling argument. Let me rephrase that. It's not really an argument, because this is just really a movie. But it does make it does allow for some open-minded thinking about how did these people, who we consider to be so ancient and so backward technologically, construct these amazing wonders? And why can't it be a Stargate? The acting in the movie is a little bit better than average. Special effects were very good for the time. I think the movie in and of itself has aged well. It is, for me, a 3-star movie. I like this movie. I can watch this movie every once in a while and definitely not feel sorry that I did. And that is why it is on this list.
Yeah, it's a good movie. Yeah, it's a very inventive movie, especially for, what is it, like, it came out in 94, 95?
Yes, 94.
94?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Against a budget of $55 million, it did $196.5.
Now, that is what we call a growth at the box office, a getting money back. It seems like a lot of these movie companies aren't really familiar with that folklore of making money.
I hear you. I guess, why don't you go ahead and give them your 3 films, because there's going to be 2 films on there that we both picked.
Right.
Independence Day and The Patriot. We both liked them. They're more than likely for probably the same reason, for most of the same reason. So go ahead, Tim. Fill them in on this kind of interesting 3-squared that we have, where it's really 4, where it's really just 4 total movies.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing about Roland Emmerich is that you can really tell that he has fun making these movies, especially if you watch him in interviews. He's, like, smiling, he gets into it, he likes to explain why he's doing things and how the story is progressing, and you can also tell through the humor he has throughout the movies that he makes. And a lot of his movies have the same cornball humor consistent throughout the movie. And it's especially prevalent in ID4, it's prevalent in White House Down, it's in 2012, it's in The Day After Tomorrow, it's in all of his movies. But The Patriot is one of his more straightforward, action-y drama period pieces. And he also did a movie called Anonymous, which was the movie about William Shakespeare and about the guy who apparently originally wrote all of Shakespeare's plays. Which was also a good movie, but it was a little too corny at parts, so that's one of his lesser great works. But the one movie that Matt does not have on his list that I have on mine is The Day After Tomorrow from 2004. This is basically kind of the same plot as 2012, but maybe not as drastic. Basically, the entire United States is freezing over. Drastic climate change. You have Jake Gyllenhaal's in the movie. He's kind of stuck in New York where it's frozen everywhere. They're stuck in a library, and Dennis Quaid is a... I think, is he like a weather...
He's a meteorologist.
He's a meteorologist. Okay, well, I guess it would make sense, because this is the weather. Part of the movie is... Actually, the second half of the movie, after the big disaster, because, of course, these Roland Emmerich movies have to have a full hour dedicated to the disaster itself. And usually it's multiple disasters that go on throughout the movie. And then the second half is the actual kind of, like, adventure part. During the second half of the movie, it's Dennis Quaid going off to find his son, Jake Gyllenhaal. The movie is fun, it's entertaining, the special effects are pretty good. What I really like about Roland Emmerich in pretty much every movie he does is that he doesn't always rely on complete CGI. He still kind of works with models, he works with sets. When he has to flood a room, he actually floods a room. He doesn't flood a green screen room, just basically a room with a tank and just a green screen everywhere. It's actually a set. And I really do appreciate it. He doesn't work on a small scale. His movies are big scale movies. And that is, he is so comfortable in it. You can just tell in all these movies. So without going into, you know, too much detail, it's The Day After Tomorrow. My other favorites are Independence Day and The Patriot.
And of course, Independence Day is where the aliens come and they blow up the White House and they blow up New York and everything.
Yeah.
And Will Smith comes in and saves the day, so along with Jeff Goldblum. So there's that too. And then finally, of course, The Patriot is the 2000 film with Mel Gibson, where he is the guy who starts off trying to just avoid war at all costs, and then ends up taking up the American cause because of one bad British dude who kills his son, and he and his little Rough Riders end up kind of more or less helping to turn the tide of the war, and we win and become a nation.
And even the Patriot has some pretty good humor in it as well. Not really, again, not as campy as his other movies, but such a good movie. I mean, I love the movie. That's usually in everybody's... If anybody has a DVD collection, and I'm talking about anybody, I usually find that within their collection of DVDs, The Patriot.
And that would be no exception here.
Yes.
All right, well, excellent. So then next week's Three Squared, we are going to do... Go ahead, give us the topic, Tim.
Next week, Three Squared will be our three favorite great debut from a screenwriter turned director. And believe it or not, there are a number of them out there. A lot of them are going to be lesser well-known. It might be a good history lesson for our listeners, those who aren't really familiar with either classic film or some of the lesser-known writers-turned-directors.
To make sure that we have it straight here, the Three Squared for next week is going to be our picks for screenwriters who have made great transitions from screenwriting to directing.
Correct.
Outstanding. All right. So then let us go to the final section, the movies. The movies. All right, so we had three movies this week. We had World War Z, Monsters University, and White House Down. Now, we also did kind of a bonus flick that we're not going to focus on so much. Olympus Has Fallen. We did Olympus Has Fallen mainly to compare and contrast versus White House Down.
It's going to be the easiest compare and contrast. It's only going to be more like contrast.
Yeah, this is going to be ridiculous. But we're going to start with World War Z. This is the Brad Pitt flick. They just basically say it's more or less it's zombies. They're not so much the undead, but they are the converted, so to speak. And Brad Pitt plays a guy who, I don't know, worked for UNICEF or something, Peace Corps, some crap. He's supposed to be some badass investigator who's retired and just wants to be with his family. However, with the crisis that has just, the worldwide crisis of this infection that has taken over the world, he has to try and figure out what happened and how to fight it. This movie definitely had some reshoots going on, and it is abundantly clear when you watch the movie, you're like, well, that's not even what they said in the trailer. Or, though that's kind of how it was presented in the trailer, but that is not how it's being presented in the... It is vastly evident. And I've got to say that it must have worked, because the movie, not bad. For me, this is a solid 3-star movie. I like... It definitely has its flaws, but not enough to make you sit there and go, oh my god, am I having to watch this? The ending of the movie... Actually, Tim, I'll let Tim explain more about the ending of the movie, because he actually has a little bit of background on the ending of the movie. The ending of the movie didn't really do very much for me. It's one of those voiceover, cautiously optimistic ones where it's, you know, oh, we got a band together, it's the only way we'll ever solve all of our world problems. And yet, at the same time, it was fitting, because it was a nice close to the story, and yet allowed, clearly, leaving the door open for a sequel. I mean, we even talked about this as a news segment a few weeks back, with as much disavowing and people saying bad things, people involved with the movie saying bad things, studios being very wary of what's going on. I gotta say that they got lucky here. It pulled it off. It was not one young lady who plays a Mossad officer, I think is what they're called, basically an Israeli officer. And she's played by Daniela Kurtzets. And I thought she did a really great job, personally. It brought a pretty interesting layer to the movie that I would have liked to have seen more of. Brad Pitt does a good job. Brad Pitt is Brad Pitt. You're not going to expect anything less of him. And, I mean, honestly, this movie, I don't think this movie could have turned out any better based on all the turmoil that had happened with throughout. What do you think, Tim?
One thing, okay, so... Those who've listened to the show on a weekly basis will know that I kind of put this movie through the ringer even before I saw it. I said I wasn't going to see it, but I had the chance to go catch it before another movie, and I just thought, ah, what the hell. Surprisingly, I enjoyed it, though it is so obvious that this movie, like what Matt was saying, has gone through reshoots. Because I was, what I was telling Matt during the pre-show is that you'll see a different camera angle during a scene, and you'll hear somebody talking, like the shot will be set up from behind, and you can clearly see the side of the face to where if they were actually moving their mouth, you can see their neck move and all this stuff. However, you hear the voice, but you don't see the person moving, you don't see the person talking, but you get the reaction from, like, Brad Pitt. It's usually from Brad Pitt's reaction shots, and you just hear what the other people are saying, because I think how they kind of worked the new ending into the movie is by going back and changing bits and pieces of the dialogue from the beginning and the middle of the movie. Therefore, by adding dialogue when the original dialogue was something different, was probably dialogue that was setting up the original ending to the movie. Especially during the whole thing about talking about the virus and them having to go to the World Health Organization there at the end, because the World Health Organization wasn't even supposed to be in the movie. Finding the virus to mask, because the whole plot line of finding the other viruses for the humans to take to kind of mask them from the terror of these zombies wasn't the original plot line. However, before I get into all that, and I'll read this, you know, few paragraphs here about the original ending of the movie, and it's pretty fascinating. World War Z took too much time setting up and explaining the various scenarios throughout the plot. For example, every time Brad Pitt is kind of put into a grandiose situation, like when he goes to Israel, or whenever he's in what city is he in? Boston? Is he in Boston or Chicago? Or he's in Philadelphia. Yeah, when he's in Philadelphia and all this stuff is going on, but especially when he's at this airport and he's having to run from the inside of the airport into a plane, and with him he has the Marines with him, or the army or whatever, giving him ground cover. Well, before that whole situation kind of happens, the Marines or his backup is kind of getting ready. So once they go outside, it automatically turns into, the movie automatically turns into video game mode. I mean, that's when you hear, "All right, guys, remember troops, zombies die easily if you shoot them in the head. Just remember that." Kind of like if you play a video game, a first-person shooter, and, you know, they kind of give you these tips as you're starting off the game, you're walking through the level whenever it's nighttime, and you know those games where, you know, you have about 20 seconds before you're really in danger, your character's about to get shot at, or I guess in this case eaten by zombies, but between that time you kind of have the objective coming in from your commander or whatever. So that kind of happened one too many times just to kind of fill in inconsistencies in the plot, so it was pretty forced. But other than that, the acting was pretty damn decent. I was quite surprised, and again, I thought the movie was pretty entertaining. Not a lot of gore in the movie. I don't know if you noticed that, Matt, that there was no gore whatsoever, hardly any blood. Whenever he uses his hatchet to actually kill, or crowbar to kill a zombie, you don't see any crowbar penetration whatsoever. Unlike the Paperboy and Dogtooth from last week, the penetration's all there. World War Z, no zombie penetration. Actually, that could be good title.
That was actually something that was, I thought, was really kind of cool. And it's honestly, it's a nice break. I have absolutely no problem with violence, cursing, blood, gore. Every different strokes for different folks, and as long as, for me, it needs to kind of make sense for the most part, with very few exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, I do still believe that it takes a higher degree of class and a better degree of skill to do that kind of stuff, get the point across, and do it without cursing, do it without lots of blood. And that crowbar scene was a prime example, especially when he has clearly done such a good job with the crowbar that he can't pry it out from the skull. And they do a very good job of setting that up without having to show any of it. I thought that was very, very well done.
So they kind of took the Halloween approach, Wes Craven's Halloween.
Exactly.
So finally, are you ready to hear about the ending? Because it's a good one. So I'll go ahead and read it. This is from, Cinema Blend again. This is kind of a Cinema Blendy show on my part. And again, this is by author Christy Puchko. So Puchko has been putting out a lot of articles as of lately. Now again, these are spoilers. Spoilers beware, they are ahead. Last week, quote, "Last week, details on what last-minute hires Damon Lindelof and Drew Goddard brought to the screenplay were revealed, telling us that essentially everything that Jerry, Brad Pitt's character, boards the plane leaving Jerusalem is new. There was some mention that prior finale involved a big bloody battle in Russia, but not much else was said as to what was discarded from the old draft of the film. But Movies.com has uncovered an early draft of the screenplay, and while it's unknown how much of this version was actually shot, it presents a very different and much bleaker World War Z. And it goes on. Instead of Jerry and the Israeli soldier Segan ending up at the World Health Organization facility, where they discover that people with terminal illnesses are invisible to the zombie world, World War Z's original ending was the pair headed to Moscow, where they arrive without incident. From there, the passengers are divided, the sick and elderly are executed, and everyone else, Jerry included, are forced into military service to fight the zombie threat. Here, Jerry loses his cell phone and thereby his lifeline to his wife and kids. Cut to, months later, Jerry is cold-eyed but effective zombie killer, leading a battalion who kills with lobos, a sort of shovel battle axe, mentioned in the original book. Movies.com has a lot of details about how the battles in Russia go, including a bizarre decision to divide up the fighters by their religion and a discovery about how to stop the zombies that's totally, totally different from the one we see on film. After more successes on the zombie battling front, he finally calls Karen, who, like in the movie, has been moved to a refugee camp. But in this version, it's in the Everglades, far from the protection of cold temperatures. Worse yet, it's the kind of place when you are forced to barter for safety, and Karen's been bartering her body to a sleazy soldier who, for months before, had helped Jerry and the kids into that saving helicopter. If you were watching very, very closely, you might have noticed that soldier who was about one line of dialogue was played by Matthew Fox, who was thought to have been dropped from the film. In the original version of the film, however, Fox's parajumper character calls Jerry back after Karen hangs up on him and basically tells him to move on with his life. Jerry refuses and takes his phone and friends and sets off to find Karen in the draft. I'm excited to see the deleted scenes to see exactly what they actually shot.
I don't know. I think that the ending that it got, that World War Z got, is fine. I think if it doesn't get a sequel, it's just fine. I think that it leaves it so that while we know that there's going to be more, they're going to get it worked out. And if they do show more, it's just how they ultimately end up working it out. Next up, Monsters University, the prequel to the hit movie from 2001, Monsters, Inc. And it brings, I was very impressed because it brings back Billy Crystal, John Goodman, and Steve Buscemi. And it shows, it is exactly what it implies. It's them in college showing how they eventually work their way to Monsters, Inc. and set up the events of Monsters, Inc.
Yeah, they handled that pretty well. I like that.
I was a little bothered by the retconning that they did. Aside from the retconning that they did, I thought that they still made excellent headway showing how these guys end up being together, becoming the partners that they are, and where Randall fits into the whole thing, setting up how Monsters, Inc. all rolls into it. I really enjoyed this movie. I'm giving it 4 stars. There's not really a whole lot to say. It's the classic underdog movie. But this one, what I liked about this movie was they took a very unique path to focus on Mike Wazowski. Where you still get just as many equal parts and equal character development out of Sully. Monsters, Inc. is more about Sully and his relationship with Boo. Here, it's all about Mike Wazowski and his dream to be a scarer. And it's kind of funny to see how the road it takes. But throughout the movie, you see just exactly what it is that makes him such an amazing planner for Sully later on. And it's part Revenge of the Nerd, or Revenge of the Nerds in there too. There's a little bit of that aspect thrown into it. Definitely a lot of classic college or collegiate action, classic high school prank action, because you have to remember that this is all set up from the perspective of these guys are adults who have been adults for a while. In terms of Monsters, Inc., in 2001, these guys have been adults for a while. They have plans, they have lives, they're good friends. And all of this stuff is camaraderie, and you know that they've been together for years and years and years. So they have to actually go back, and it's definitely, you get the impression that they've set that up so that this is at least 20 years in the past. But they do it so that there's nothing clearly dated. And I thought that Helen Mirren did a fantastic job as the Dean. Full of grace and scary as fuck. I mean, I could seriously see, if I was a little kid, I would be creeped out by this chick. Great cameos, by the way. There are cameos from just about every single person in the original Monsters, Inc. And they were also very faithful, because where it did not make sense to give vocal cameos, they give visual cameos. Which is kind of a bummer, because it would have been nice to hear from everybody. But this is not one of those ways that they can do that. The movie itself is extremely predictable. And of course it has to be, because you know what Monsters, Inc. is about. And yet, they still throw in a couple of fun little delightful tidbits along the way, including one small little twist at the end that I'm not going to expose, but you are kind of like, oh, well, how are they going to work that out? Which they do take the next 3 or 4 minutes and work it out for you. I like it. 4 stars. Monsters University. Go check it out.
It seems like that the jokes in this one were a little too far in between, but it's a different kind of movie. This one's a little more visual to look at. There's a lot more story to it. What I find kind of interesting is that they kind of taken the stereotypical college movie and added on to it, kind of what you come to expect from a Pixar movie. I mean, even especially with Toy Story 3 kind of setting the bar for a dynamic animated movie, because contemplation of death is even in that movie. It's kind of hard to even top that, but Monsters University kind of finds a way to work around that whole concept. However, this is kind of what I said with Brave from last year, is that I kind of feel that Pixar has sort of lost its charm. It's got the sentiment there completely, but it's just the lighthearted comedy that I miss, the wit, I mean. It seems like they're kind of falling into the realm of more practical jokes than they are with witty humor, I guess, which I love from, like, Toy Story, even A Bug's Life, for example, and a few others. Even, you know, Finding Nemo. And especially The Incredibles. I mean, man, The Incredibles had some of the best humor in a Pixar movie I've ever seen. But other than that, I mean, like I said, the movie is quite entertaining. Great kids movie, great family movie. I even recommend it. So, there you go.
All right. Now, this brings us to our compare and contrast. Primarily, we're going to be focusing on White House Down, but we're comparing and contrasting it to Olympus Has Fallen, which ostensibly has the same plot. That is, terrorists take over the White House.
You know, it's the same plot down to the president receiving a gift from their wife, and that gift happens to be the same thing, pretty much a pocket watch. So,
well, it was a wristwatch in Olympus Has Fallen.
Oh, true. Yeah.
And it was his grandfather's wristwatch versus President Abraham Lincoln's pocket watch given to him by his wife.
And of course, that's only in a Roland Emmerich movie would it have been a Abraham Lincoln watch. It's so far-fetched, which is another... You know, it's another way to tell if you're watching a Roland Emmerich movie, because I don't think if it was a Martin Scorsese movie, I don't think it would be so specific as a Abraham Lincoln watch.
Indeed. I'm going to say here, White House Down for me was... I feel very comfortable saying that this movie, White House Down, is definitely this generation's Die Hard. All the way down to Channing Tatum wearing a wife beater, just like Bruce Willis did in Die Hard.
Well, this is what Die Hard 5 should have been, to be honest. I mean...
Maybe. I don't know. I gotta say, it's... They set it up, and it plays out a lot of the same way as Die Hard did. He's estranged from his daughter. He's divorced from his wife. Where in Die Hard, he's estranged from his entire family and almost getting divorced from his wife. But instead of saving his wife in Die Hard, Channing Tatum's got to save his daughter. Ridiculous. This is why I'm not a big fan of kids in action movies, because they always make the kids do the most ridiculous fucking contrary thing I've ever seen in my life. And you know that no kid would go out of their way to do this. Olympus Has Fallen. We'll shift gears. Look over at Olympus Has Fallen. Olympus Has Fallen is a piece of shit movie and is nowhere near as good. Please don't watch it. Gerard Butler, I think, did a little bit better job overall than Channing Tatum. It would have, I think it would have been pretty cool to see him in White House Down. That being said, I think Channing Tatum did an okay job. I actually found myself liking his character, which is hard for me to say, especially after having watched the G.I. Joe movies. I don't know what's wrong with me, but I did end up liking his character by the end of this movie. Coming back to White House Down, the movie then ultimately plays out. Tons of explosions. Of course, guess what? Oh yeah, the White House explodes. Who made this movie? Roland Emmerich? What? Yes, crazy, I know. Oh yeah, the Capitol building explodes too.
Yeah.
Maggie Gyllenhaal is in this movie. She's looking just as cancer patient as ever. Is that? I think that's a pretty accurate description of what she looks like, right? Does she not look like a cancer patient all the time? Well, don't misunderstand. I'm not saying she's a bad actress. She's an all right actress. I don't mind her as a... I'm sorry, she creeps me out. The way she looks... Look, I'm fat. That's fine. I'm not trying to say that we should judge her or hate her or what have you. I'm sorry, she looks like... Her face is too... You know what it is? It's kind of like she's a semi-attractive version of Eric Stoltz's character in Mask. I'm sorry, that's just what I see. It kind of creeps me out. She looks like a cancer patient. I don't
hate
her.
You're talking about Cher's Mask, right?
No!
Isn't Cher it?
Yeah, the movie was Cher. Eric Stoltz played the kid. Mask, yeah. Right? Yeah. The movie Mask that starred Cher. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Eric Stoltz, right.
Right.
Don't get me wrong. I don't hate her. I wish her well. She's clearly crying all the way to the bank. She certainly gives a flying fuck what I think of her. But this is how I feel. I just telling you how I feel. She looks like a cancer patient, and always does. Carrying on, James Woods plays. I'm not trying to be. Whatever. This is supposed to be entertaining, so I hope you're entertained. Oh, you're not entertained. James Woods plays the ever irascible character that only James Woods can play, and he really is a cancer patient. If that helps any, although he seems to be having a heart attack halfway through, and then it turns out he's got cancer or something. So, whatever. James Woods is, this is no spoiler here. James Woods is the bad guy, and if you can't figure it out in the first 5 seconds where he takes the American flag pin out of his suit lapel while looking disgusted, you're stupid. Leave. Go get your money back. You don't deserve to watch this movie. He's the bad guys, but he, of course, is playing it perfectly. The only thing, there are really only three major things that bothered me about this movie. And two of the three of them are, in my opinion only, because I don't want to turn this into a fight, Tim.
Bring it.
Is because Roland Emmerich is a hardcore leftist.
Mm-hmm.
I get really pissed off when it seems like the only people you're allowed to pick on in the world are conservatives or, shall we say, right-wing radical nut jobs, like the dude who is one of the bad guys in this movie. Yeah, another one of the bad guys is apparently the only other group that you're allowed to pick on anymore, which is neo-Nazis. So we have the right-wing militia nut job, who's one of the bad guys. And that's okay, because never in the history of the world has there ever been anyone on the left side of the political spectrum who's been, like, crazy with guns and, like, tried to kill people. Nope, that doesn't happen, so we can't do that. And then, never in the history of the world have we ever had any other type or group of bad guy other than Nazis, ever, in the history. So we have to have neo-Nazis.
Well, that's true, but
not done yet,
okay.
Not done yet.
Okay.
And then they have also, because apparently the only ridiculous media people in the world are only available on the right of the political spectrum, so they have to have the Rush Limbaugh wannabe, who is a blubbering fucking idiot and just spends the entire time sobbing until he decides to stand up with his tear-stained face and get, like, shot in the gut or something stupid. I guess this really boils down to two things. The one thing is the group of retard people that they have, being the militia nut, the neo-Nazi guy, and then the person they make fun of, which is supposed to be Rush Limbaugh. The second thing that I have is something that I touched on before, which is the girl. The girl is this precocious YouTube channel owning Jamie Foxx's character. Jamie Foxx is the president, right? President James Sawyer. James Sawyer loving freak who spits in the face of terrorists and runs out and saves the whole world by waving a flag on the lawn. It's just stupid. It's the dumbest plot device I've ever seen used. I hate it when they use kids
this
way.
But Matt, she's a flag twirler.
Whatever. It was just waving a stupid flag.
Wouldn't you want your child to, if she wanted to be a flag twirler, to twirl the ultimate flag on the ultimate front lawn of the ultimate house in America?
No.
You shot me. Shot through the heart.
I mean, but seriously, it's a completely weak plot device that is just way overused, way over the top. And in a movie that is so over the top, you could do a million other things in this universe that the movie's happening in. You don't need to do that one. You don't need to do that thing. I still say, despite those things, I'm taking my wife. We're going to go back and see this one because she likes Channing Tatum anyway. And I still, despite that stuff, give it 4 stars, even though that first thing really pisses me off.
Well, cool. Yeah, it's definitely an entertaining way to spend 2 hours and 17 minutes. Like I was saying before, Roland Emmerich, his movies are filled completely with cornball humor. That stuff doesn't necessarily bother me. I mean, and I'm not talking about the conservative and liberal thing, but like, usually I'm really bothered by special effects if the special effects are obviously special effects, or if the humor is obvious stupid humor, or if plot devices are obviously stupid over the top plot devices just so the overly upstanding American people in the audience will want to stand up and cheer because this little girl is twirling her flag, twirling her heart out.
And the dialogue of the pilot when that's going down. Do I have to go, sir? Do I have to go? I can't do it. There's no way I'm going to do that. I'm pulling away. I'm pulling away. You know, come on. I mean,
Yeah, but I mean, it's like you have all the stuff that's going on that is ridiculous. And again, like this, it takes a little while. If you're as critical as I am with these kind of movies, if you can get past the first 30 minutes and let that all that stuff just kind of settle in, because it'll happen pretty quick, and you will either have to settle in or just leave the theater because you still have another hour and a half to go, pretty much. Then you can enjoy this movie. I don't think this is a great movie. This isn't one of my favorite movies, action movies, but this is the closest thing to Die Hard than Die Hard 4 or Die Hard 3 or whatever. I mean, this is one of the better action movies that has come out in years. The movement of the movie is perfect. With Olympus Has Fallen, The movie is stagnant. The story is stagnant. Yes. There's not a lot of set pieces. They're staying in one room for most of the movie.
I will say this, though. The one thing that I wish had been transposed from Olympus Has Fallen to White House Down is I liked their bad guys. Their bad guys were Korean, North Korean, essentially.
Yeah.
And I thought was so much cooler other than where they kind of went the Rock version of bad guys, where they're disgruntled American forces people.
But that means we would have had to have read subtitles. And we didn't get to see all the crummy special effects.
True.
But, you know, it's fun. Again, I mean, the movement is a definite plus for White House Down. In the set pieces, it kind of, you know, you kind of look forward to seeing what they're going to blow up next or where the next fight scene's going to be. You know, it's an enjoyable movie for those who like action flicks. So I'd have to recommend it.
Awesome. All right. Well, then next week's movies are going to be Despicable Me 2, The Lone Ranger, and a little foreshadowing here, something that people have been comparing The Lone Ranger to, at least one specific aspect of The Lone Ranger 2. We are going to be watching the namesake of that, The General, the silent film movie featuring Buster Keaton. And we're going to be going through all those. So we got 2 more coming out this week movies to see in the theater and 1 Netflix movie. I think that's it then. Are we ready for the spiel, sir?
Spiel on.
All right, the music that you've been listening to, as always, has been provided to us by our music partners, Cries of Solace. You can check them out at criesofsolace.com, reverbnation.com. You can also check them out at MySpace and Facebook.com, the last three, /Cries of Solace. As far as we're concerned, you can always go to our website, slscast.com. You can also check us out on Facebook by searching for Cries of Solace. You can follow us on Twitter at the SLS Cast. You can send us email to the SLScast at gmail.com and subscribe to us on iTunes. And so, until next week, this is Matt saying, we'll see you next week.
Cheers, guys.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.